All right, how is everybody? You guys have them ready for the beer or the access words, I'm sure. So just a quick intro. I'm Michael Washam. I'm a ex-Microsoft alumni, previous SharePoint escalation engineer. I'm sorry, but I used to have to debug this thing. But anyways, the session today is gonna be all focused on how to take a SharePoint farm and run it in Windows Azure. How many of you are Azure users today? Oh, cool. Okay, so a few. How many of you actually have an Azure subscription that you just haven't used yet? All right, so this is a pretty green audience. This is going to be good. So let's go ahead and jump in a little bit. So what we're going to talk about today is I'm going to kind of give you an introduction on what Azure is, why it's important, and why you should actually run SharePoint farms specifically in Azure. I'm going to talk a little bit about hybrid connectivity. So usually whenever we're talking about running SharePoint farms, we're talking about running in an enterprise. And usually in an enterprise, there are actual connectivity issues, resources back in your on-premises data center that make it a challenge for putting a full-blown SharePoint farm up in the cloud and actually having it be useful. Most of your data is probably going to be on-prem, so we're going to talk about the scenarios you can use to make that, be able to talk to that. So beyond hybrid connectivity, I'm going to talk a little bit about best practices, some of the things you should do to make sure your SharePoint farm runs successfully, fairly quickly, high performance, that kind of stuff. And finally, I'm going to kind of give you guys some resources on how to jump up and get started. If you're brand new to Azure, it's always an entry point. Where do I go to actually get started? So the very first thing I want to talk about is where you should be. So I'm sure a lot of you have probably already seen the slide. It's a very common theme slide when you're talking about Office 365 or SharePoint farms or just running SharePoint for dev and test. Generally, this chart tells you that farther to the left is much more control, right? If you're hosting your SharePoint farm on premises, you have full control over the hardware. So you manage the servers, you manage the SAN, you manage the network stack, you manage the end-to-end scenario. This could be clustering, load balancing, firewall, you name it. Farther to the right, you lose a little bit less control, but hopefully you're gaining cost efficiencies. So right in the middle, which is where we're talking about today, is running SharePoint on infrastructure services, actually in Azure. So the value prop for running SharePoint in Azure is hopefully you gain a lot of agility because you're no longer managing the underlying hardware stack. You're not provisioning physical servers, you're not running cables, you're not waiting on people to actually ship you servers and plug them into your data center. You're really just managing the software layer. And the beauty between Azure and on-prem is that part doesn't change. You still have full control over the applications that can run on your server, the code that you can run on the server, because it's, for all intents and purposes, your farm. You can do whatever you want to with it. And all the way to the farthest of the right, Office 365. Obviously, this is going to be the most cost efficient, probably the most value add from a management perspective, because you're, for the most part, not managing it. It all really depends on your application needs. You know, if you have a solution that has to run in your own SharePoint farm, then really the question is whether you're running it in Azure or on your own on-premises environment. So a little bit of value add, why you should choose Azure, is really one of the biggest reasons is Azure's global footprint. So this year alone, there's going to be 16 global regions that you can actually deploy servers into. So you can deploy a SharePoint farm in pretty much all over the world almost in 16 global locations. This allows you to get closer to your customers, data locality, so you get better performance, and also a pretty much wide variety of where you can plug in your data centers to for closer connectivity to your on-premises data centers. Now, how many of you have ever deployed a server in Azure, a virtual machine? None. Okay, great. So what exactly are infrastructure services? That's what we're talking about today. Well, it consists of cloud-based virtual machines. So just like you run virtual machines in Hyper-V today or VMware or whatever solution you choose, you can run the same types of virtual machines up in Azure. That's really the core of infrastructure services. It's based on Hyper-V, so Azure is actually built on Server 2012 Hyper-V, and this basically allows you to run workloads that traditionally you would run on-premises up in the cloud. So it doesn't take you to re-architecture of your application, you don't have to write new code, you can literally lift and shift existing apps and run them up in Azure. The second part of infrastructure services is networking pieces of it. So as your networking, there's a lot of really advanced capabilities that you can do, and a lot of them, whenever you're talking SharePoint, SharePoint's very heavy on two things, disk and network. So understanding the underlying networking concepts for SharePoint is really critical. So some of the features we'll talk about in more detail, virtual networks, this gives you a private IPv4 address space that you can deploy your virtual machines into. You get hybrid connectivity, and we'll go into that in a lot of detail later, which is basically allows you to take your virtual machines up in Azure and connect them to your data center that the rest of your data is located in. Other features like access control lists, so you have all this stuff up in Azure, how do you lock it down? External and now internal load balancing, which was something Azure didn't have before, and reserved IPs, which is also a new feature. And put all this together, and this is how you can run these lift and shift type workloads without rewriting and re-architecting your apps. So why host in Azure Virtual Machines? So the first thing, you're thinking about hosting your own SharePoint farm, so you're already made the decision that you need a lot of control, right? Office 365 won't cut it because maybe you have legacy code, maybe you have code that just doesn't work migrating forward, or maybe you just want to run the stuff on your own servers where you run management applications on it and you have full direct control over that farm. Azure gives you the same abilities that you do on premises minus managing the underlying infrastructure, which is why it's called infrastructure as a service. The other thing you get is agility. So once you have a virtual machine up in Azure, it's really just a bunch of entities. You know, it's not like a physical server that you have and you have to carry around if you want to make a copy of it. Azure, I can literally make copies of the disks. I can move them to different storage accounts. I can copy them to different subscriptions. I can make a backup of it. I can restore it. I can script it. It's all just programmable resources. So given enough time and investment, you can automate anything to do with Azure and specifically SharePoint. And so I'm going to show you this as an example. This laptop is gigantic. And the reason it's gigantic is because I'm running SharePoint on Hyper-V. I absolutely do not like that anymore. I used to have to do that as a SharePoint consultant and an escalation engineer. I'd run everything locally, and I'd debug it, and I'd try it out. I don't do that anymore except to show you how painful this is. Now, so the general idea is you host all your servers up in Azure, and you don't have to. You know, you can actually manage SharePoint on your little Surface or iPad if you wanted to. From a supportability perspective, 2010 and 2013 are both supported. In the Azure Image Gallery, there is a platform base image available for SharePoint 2013, and I'll go over what you can and can't do with that shortly. If you have existing licenses and you want to move them up to Azure, you can do that for software assurance. And since there is no SharePoint 2010 image, there's a KB article that tells you how SysPrep and 2010 all work together cozy, and you can put that article together with Azure to actually make your own custom image. Okay, and finally, FastSearch 2010 is officially not supported. So if you're a FastSearch server on 2010 customer, Azure is not for you yet. Okay, so let's start with the simplest scenario. So you're brand new to Azure, which sounds like most of you are. You probably don't want to jump into a SharePoint farm right off the bat. You maybe just want to try it out on a single virtual machine and see how it works and kind of get your feel for it. So some good examples for this are doing development tests. Maybe you're a SharePoint developer, or maybe you have a team of SharePoint developers. They don't necessarily need 15 gigantic servers, but they do need a SharePoint VM that they can test their code on, they can deploy solutions, they can try some script and not blow up your existing environment. Another good environment for this is demos. So you write some code and you want to go show it to your boss or your business owner or application owner, put it on a single VM, deploy your solution, and now you instantly have this without having to, again, lug the giant laptop around. So some of the concepts you need for this one scenario, you need to understand what virtual machine sizes are available, you need to understand what cloud services are, and you need to know where your disks are, where the underlying storage is for your Azure virtual machines. So here are the SharePoint instance sizes, starting all the way from extra small, which is a shared core and 768 megs of RAM, obviously probably not the best candidate for a SharePoint server, all the way up through the A9. The A8 and A9 are brand new instance sizes just available for virtual machines. These guys have very high speed, high performance CPUs, and they have InfiniBand networks, so they're really meant for high-end computing tasks, which SharePoint probably could qualify for. But in general, as a general rule, whenever you're spinning up SharePoint VMs, they're usually going to fall in this range. In the A5, the extra large with 14 gigs of memory and 8 cores, up to the A6 with 4 cores and 28 gigs, depending on which workload, which services you have running on Azure or on SharePoint. Okay, so let's talk about cloud services. Anyone know what a cloud service is? The one guy, the guy that did that Azure before. So what a cloud service is in Azure, it's a very Azure-specific element. Whenever you create a virtual machine in Azure, in the portal or in PowerShell or whatever, you always have to reference which cloud service the virtual machine itself is being created in. All it is, it's a container. So if you create a virtual machine or more than one virtual machine, they go into a cloud service at some point. The cloud service does a few things for you. First, it acts as a network and a security boundary. So all virtual machines in the same cloud service can talk to each other on the same private network. All virtual machines in the same cloud service can also be load balanced if you want to. So if you have, you know, 3 web servers and 2 app servers, you could actually load balance the front end web servers using, as long as they're in the same cloud service. And there's another feature called availability sets. I'll talk about that shortly. That's also part of grouping virtual machines into cloud services. Something you should know about a cloud service, every one has a public IP address. So in this example, spdemo.cloudup.net, 137.135.67.36. What does that mean to you? It means that is a public IP. So if you want to host, for example, an extranet or a publishing, you know, anonymous publishing site, that would be the IP address you would hit externally. One thing to note is all the virtual machines in your cloud service, for some reason you shut them down from PowerShell or the portal, that IP address disappears. There's a new feature just introduced this week called reserved IP. So if you are doing you are doing true extranet sites like an extranet or a publishing site, use a reserved IP in this cloud service and you'll keep that IP forever. Here's a real quick example of how you can create a reserved IP in PowerShell. Essentially, you create the new Azure reserved IP using a commandlet. It'll actually instantiate that inside of your subscription. And from then on, you call new Azure VM, and these are all PowerShell commandlets you use to automate Azure. Whenever you call this, it's actually going to create the cloud service and do the reserved IP at the same time for you. Sure. So, good question. So the question was, when would you deallocate a virtual machine? And a really good answer is anytime you have a virtual machine running, it's allocated, you're paying for it. If you, from PowerShell or from the portal, you actually go and shut it down, you're not paying for it anymore. And behind the scenes, what's going on is you're actually deallocating that virtual machine from Fabric. And that's basically how they do the billing. So it's no longer reserving space in the compute resources. Your configuration is still saved, but it's no longer reserving actual compute time. So if you shut down all the virtual machines in a cloud service, it essentially deallocates all of them, and at that point, you lose your IP. With the reserved IP feature, you don't no longer have to worry about it anymore, but you do need to make sure you use a reserved IP when you're running into this scenario. And finally, the final concept we want to talk about for this one scenario is Azure storage. So every virtual machine you create in Azure, is the disk is actually not persisted on the local disk by the server, it's actually stored off in Windows Azure Storage, which itself is a multi-tenant, highly durable, highly available service meant for storing, you guessed it, files. So whenever you're looking at a virtual machine, the C drive, any data disk attached to it, they're all going to be not stored on the local machine, they're going to be stored off in this service called storage. The one thing you do need to keep in mind is every virtual machine in Azure also has a D drive attached to it. The D drive is labeled very clearly temporary. And the reason it is because that's the only disk on your virtual machine that's actually pointing to the direct attached storage on server in the data center. And the reason that's good and bad, it's good because it's direct attached storage, it's actually very quick, it's very fast IO, but it's bad because if anything happens to that physical server, or you resize your virtual machine and Azure needs to move your VM to another physical server, all the data on that disk is gone whenever you're moved. So the D drive, for all intents and purposes, is only treated as very temporary. Don't put anything on there you want to keep forever. Okay, so let's walk through a real quick example of how you can do this, getting started with a single VM. We're starting from zero. You want to try out Azure. You want to show it to your boss. You want to just see if it works, that kind of thing. So let me flip over to my demo machine. Okay, so the very first thing I want to show you guys is creating a new virtual machine in Azure. So if I go to New Compute, Virtual Machine, and I go from Gallery, I have all these different platform images I can start from. So from a SharePoint perspective, we'd probably by default say, hey, okay, I want to try the SharePoint Server 2013 trial. That's the image I'd want to start with. And how this image is configured, it basically has SharePoint configured in farm mode. So when I boot it up, the very first thing it's going to want to do is wonder where my database server is and what my domain credentials are. On a single virtual machine, I don't have AD, I don't have SQL. So if I want to do this as a single VM, it's probably not the best place to start. It's really meant for deploying farms, and it's actually really meant for automating deployments of farms. So you can try that, but keep in mind that you're going to have to deploy a couple of other servers or install AD and SQL on the same box. Another option, if you have MSDN, of course I'm on a subscription that doesn't have MSDN, change over to one. How many of you have an MSDN subscription? Okay, so as long as you have an MSDN subscription, there's a couple of virtual machine images that are available to you as MSDN subscribers that have the perfect kind of mix of SharePoint for you. So if I go to New Compute Virtual Machine from Gallery, and I go down to MSDN, you'll see a bunch of images in here. And these are really meant for developer images, but even if you're a developer or an IT pro, the SharePoint one is very valuable, because essentially if you pick a Visual Studio 2013 Ultimate Update 2, I know it's a mouthful for booting up a SharePoint VM, if you create a virtual machine based off this, what you end up getting is a virtual machine that has, actually, go back to it real quick. You get a virtual machine that pretty much has everything you need for booting up a single VM in SharePoint. So you'll end up with a link on the desktop, so configure developer desktop, go into scripts, and there's three different links here. You configure a SharePoint farm, you can configure a SharePoint farm in a domain, or you can configure a SQL server. If I just run the configure SharePoint farm, if you look at the script, what it's really asking, it's asking for local credentials. So it's gonna take my local username, my local password, it's gonna configure SQL, and it's gonna basically install SharePoint in a single VM mode only. So at this point, you have SharePoint on its own, and you can try it out in Azure. So in this case, my resolution on this is wonky. Oh well. So in this case, this is a virtual machine. It's the same image that I provisioned up from MSDN. So if I go to manage web applications on my central admin, you see I basically have two sites provisioned, the internet site. So if I browse to that, basically get the SharePoint team publishing site or the team site. And I've also provisioned a publishing site that I can access, and this is set up to be anonymous. So really, really quick and simple, you can basically spin up a virtual machine, run a PowerShell script, answer two questions, and you can have a SharePoint server that you can try out. Now, just to finish that out, since we didn't actually see a virtual machine being created, if you wanted to do the same thing I just showed, you would pick Ultimate. What's that? Oh, you're right. Thank you. Windows 8.1. So that was a client SKU. Good catch. There we go. Make sure you picked a Windows Server 2012 one. Okay. And then you basically just enter your local username and password. Give it a unique cloud service name. Remember, I said a cloud service is a container for all your virtual machines. It does have a public DNS name that has to be globally unique within Azure. And that's what this little green check is telling me, that SP Demo 1 Service 1 is globally available for me. And here, I need to pick the region I'm going to deploy to. So this could be West US. A storage account. And basically, the storage accounts are Azure storage. You create one of these for based on the region you want to deploy to. And finally, whenever you're creating a single VM, you can actually deploy network endpoints. So I can open up port 80 for HTTP, and whenever this VM boots up, it will have SharePoint. I can run the scripts and basically have my individual SharePoint VM. OK, Okay, so the next topic I want to talk about is scaling out a little bit. So that was kind of the basics of how do we provision a single virtual machine, try it out. How do we actually go about creating a SharePoint farm? Some scenarios for running SharePoint farm in Azure, obviously production internet. Certainly, you know, a bunch of virtual machines hosted in Azure, use an external load balancer. You can do a publishing site, you can do an internet-based site, whatever. Dev and test, if you have solutions that are required to run across multiple virtual machines to be validated, great example for that. And of course, demo environment. So if you have to show your application running on multiple servers, prove it works, test its performance, this is a really good use case for it as well. So once we stretch outside of the one virtual machine scenario, though, it does get a lot more complicated. So instead of just opening up external endpoints, we kind of have to know about how Azure networking works. So I'm going to kind of give you a brief introduction. I know everyone's new to this, so not going to go too deep on it, just kind of give you the good example of ideas of what you really need to start learning. So Azure Virtual Networks. Azure Virtual Networks basically allow you to declare your own private address space up in Azure. So this gives you the ability to have private IPs that are persistent. So I can boot up a virtual machine and the IP address will stay the same for the most part. Whenever we talk about, again, this goes back to deallocation, even your internal IPs in Azure in a virtual network, they're persistent as long as you don't deallocate the VM. And the next slide, I'll kind of explain how IP allocation works. But it does support static internal IP addresses, which means if you really do need server IP or IP addresses that stay the same no matter what, you can make that happen. You just have to programmatically do it a little bit right now in PowerShell. Advanced connectivity, so support for hosting Active Directory in Azure Virtual Machines. As you know, hosting a SharePoint farm, more than one or two servers, you do need AD. And you cannot do that outside of a virtual network. So to tackle SharePoint farm, you have to have AD. Have AD, you have to have a VNet. Some additional capabilities, I can connect multiple cloud services privately on the same virtual network. So I have this cloud service with some VMs in it, I have another cloud service with some VMs in it, I can put them on the same VNet and now they can talk to each other. Some new features, I can connect virtual networks in the same or separate regions. So I can now create a virtual network in West US region and make it connect to a virtual network in East Asia if I wanted to. So I could literally declare a global private virtual network in Azure. And all of my traffic is all private on my internal network and all through the cloud with just some simple configuration changes. The second scenario that's new in the networking space is internal load balancing. So internal load balancing is actually a pretty big scenario for SharePoint because before, without the internal load balancer, it's pretty much been limited to doing extranet sites or, you know, publishing anonymous sites because for all intents and purposes, the only load balancer available in Azure has been the external load balancer. With the internal load balancer, it does make it possible for you to deploy intranet-based applications solely in the cloud. And of course, well, along with virtual networking, this gives you optional hybrid connectivity. And hybrid connectivity can be site-to-site, which is site-to-site connectivity involves connecting a VPN device on your on-premises network to a virtual network in Azure to make a IPsec tunnel over the internet. Second option is point-to-site, which basically allows me to make a VPN connection from a single machine or multiple single machines to Azure. And ExpressRoute, and I actually have a demo of ExpressRoute I'm going to show towards the end. ExpressRoute basically is a very low latency, high bandwidth, very consistent network performance and allows you to do some really creative solutions with hybrid connectivity. And just remember that if you actually do want to deploy a SharePoint farm in Azure, you do have to tackle VNet. So make sure this is probably the very first topic that you really dig into. Now, the reason you need to know about static IPs, why do I keep bringing that up? Let me give you a quick example. Whenever you define a virtual network in Azure, you have to define the address space, which means you're doing some basic subnetting. One of the subnets, say for example, is 10.0.0.0/24, which means the last bits are gonna be used for virtual machine IP addresses. Good example, if I deploy VM1 and VM2 in that order into that subnet, the very first one is gonna get the .4 address, and the second one will get the .5. And the reason that starts at .4 is because the first four IP addresses in Azure subnets are reserved. That's great. So we now know that, you know, these two virtual machines will go in consecutive order. If you deallocate them, so if you're doing dev and test, you shut all your VMs down, and then you start them up in reverse order, the IP addresses will change, and they basically go in the order of allocation. And sometimes that breaks. So if you're deploying AD and your DNS server IP address changes, obviously none of your clients are going to be able to find it, and your whole farm just died. Other solutions I've heard following over watching people deploy SharePoint, just anonymously on Twitter. I've heard that if search IP address changes, it tends to destroy your search application. I've heard a couple other things. So the general idea, if you don't want things changing, assign static IPs to your VMs. It makes life a lot easier in the long run. And there's a real simple commandlet, and I'll show how to set that static IP. But the general idea is you modify the virtual machine to have an IP address with the set Azure static VNet IP commandlet. Now, availability sets is the other feature you really need to know about when doing SharePoint. What exactly is an availability set? It's basically a label that you put on each virtual machine in the same cloud service that does the exact same workload. So if I have two web servers, I have four web servers, whatever, I would put all four of those that do the same workload in the same availability set, like WebAV, something like that. It's just a name. But what it tells Azure whenever they're grouped like this is to basically make these highly available. So it's going to take your virtual machine, say web front end 1, web front end 2, and it's going to distribute them on separate physical hardware. So you get redundancy at the router level, power supply, network cables, and physical machines. So it gives you a lot of benefit for just a really simple configuration change. The other thing it does is it tells Azure some idea about the topology of your deployment. So Azure now knows that these two web front ends are both web front ends. And you may wonder, so why would it care? Remember that Azure is based on Hyper-V. Hyper-V is obviously a Windows technology. Windows needs updates. Updates makes Windows reboots. Whenever Windows reboots, your VMs get rebooted too. How Azure does this to keep your highly available is it knows the topology, so it does a rolling update. It doesn't take down all your web front ends at the same time. Doesn't take all your domain controllers or your SQL nodes or et cetera, et cetera. It goes off and does them in a very nice consecutive update, so you're highly available. And this is the way you can get a 99.95% SLA with your Azure virtual machines. So whenever you're looking at a SharePoint farm, say it's split across, you know, your multiple logical roles like web front ends, your app tier, SQL, AD, et cetera, you're essentially gonna have each one of these groups in its own availability set. Nothing complicated, but that's really just the way you should really think about how these are architected. Now, load balancer. The first one I'm talking about is the external load balancer. Essentially, you configure this by opening up an endpoint on each virtual machine and associating it with a load balance set name. So when I create one through PowerShell, it's pretty obvious I have to give each one of these a label, and that's how it groups endpoints together. Created through the portal, you really don't see that, so it's a lot simpler, but under the covers, it's really just a name matching is how it groups these together. Again, whenever you're doing anything with an external cloud service IP, if I'm, have an extranet open or something like that, make sure you use a reserved VIP, a reserved IP. Otherwise, someday in the future, your IP will change and most likely you will be broken. How many of you ever deployed a SQL always-on listener? Anyone ever even use that? Okay. So SQL always-on, how it works in Azure, it's a little odd. Basically, since SQL always-on, the listener, it requires a virtual name. That's how you connect to one name, and SQL then figures out which server it should actually redirect you to. And how it does this in Azure is it binds itself to the external IP, that cloud service IP address, which is a little odd because that basically means your SQL server is on the public internet at that point. So a couple of things to know about that. A, make sure you use a reserved VIP here too, because if your IP address does change and you have SQL always on configured this way, whenever the IP boots up with a different name, the Azure or the SQL cluster will have absolutely no idea what's going on because the IP changed and it will stop working. There's a script you can use to fix that, but you probably don't want to be updating your SQL always on IP address every time your cloud service changes. So basically use a reserved VIP. And the other thing to remember is it is on the public internet. You do not want port 1433 on the public internet. So Azure provides the ability to lock down traffic based on port and source address. So what you would want to do is create an access control list and basically say my source cloud service IP, where all my SharePoint virtual machines are coming from, is the only thing allowed to access SQL. And now you're officially locked down. The new capability, the internal load balancer, and I predict that SQL will be able to use this instead in the next, in the next few weeks or months even. So you really won't have to worry about SQL always on the listener being external too much longer. But the internal load balancer basically accomplishes the same goal, except instead of binding to the external, the cloud service IP, you pick an IP address off your virtual network to be the load balanced IP, and from then on, anytime you hit that IP, it's gonna distribute traffic to the virtual machines that hold that endpoint. So in this case, I could type 10.0.0.100 and map that to my front-end web servers, and create a DNS entry for SP intranet that points that IP, and now I have SharePoint on the intranet hosted up in Azure. Obviously, this is implying I have some kind of hybrid connection to access my internal IPs, or all my users are running in Azure, which doesn't make a lot of sense. So this is really used in conjunction with the hybrid topologies. So a little bit of PowerShell code that shows you how to configure the internal load balancer. Has anyone ever used Azure PowerShell? All right, the one guy still. Good job. So the Azure PowerShell commandlets basically allow you to automate pretty much everything in the infrastructure service stack. I can automate virtual networks, create gateways, create VMs, add, delete disks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in this case, what we're doing here was we're creating an internal IP address. It's being allocated off an existing virtual network, so don't think this is just made up. Whenever you create your virtual network, you pick an address space, and you're basically picking an IP out of that space. And whenever I open up port 80 on the virtual machine, I'm basically saying use this internal IP, and it's going to bind that endpoint to it. And that's really all it takes to create an internal load balancer. Okay, so let's jump over to a demo for a SharePoint farm. Ooh, looky there. There's an issue in Azure. Okay. So what we have here, I have a SharePoint farm up and running in Azure right now. So let me just kind of show you all the virtual machines involved here. So I have two domain controllers, DC1 and DC2. I have two app servers, app1 and app2, and these have various app server roles. I have two web servers, two web front ends, and of course I have highly available SQL backend as well. So the SQL servers in this case are configured with always on and mirroring mode. So that means I'm not using an external listener. So for this to work, I actually have to configure SQL or SharePoint to be basically a fellow, to talk to a mirror. So the connection string to all my content databases, my admin database and everything has two server names. It has SQL1 and then the fellow over partner is gonna be SQL2. And that's how I achieve HA just using SQL mirroring alone. But it's still configured as an availability group, so I don't have to configure mirroring alone or individually on each database, which is painful. So if I look at the architecture of each of these, this is what I meant by labels for your availability groups. If I go to DC1 and I look at this availability set, basically I have DC1 and DC2, and this means that back somewhere in the Azure data center, I have a virtual machine running DC1 on a rack, and I have DC2 on another rack. And if Azure ever goes back and reboots all my machines, it's gonna do DC1 first. So all my traffic will say, hey, I can't authenticate. Oh, now I can. And they'll basically use the backup domain controller. And the same thing for each one of the logical tiers that I have deployed. So my app servers are deployed this way, and so are the web servers. And of course the SQL servers as well. So how I've deployed this at a load balancing perspective is I've configured this to use the internal load balancer. So from PowerShell, if I go into PowerShell commandlets and I go call get Azure VM, and I basically, remember how I said every virtual machine has a cloud service associated with it? The name of my cloud service is called TechEd SP Demo, and to access SP Web 1, I need to always tell it the container it's in, which is TechEd SP Demo. So if I want to get the information for that, and I actually want to see the load balancer information, I can pipe that output out to get Azure internal load balancer, and it's going to tell me that the internal IP address is 10.0.0.100. Okay, so basically I have a SharePoint farm that's listening on the intranet right now. So I can attempt to connect to this. One thing I did want to show you guys, because if you've never done Azure hybrid connectivity, this is a really cool feature that you should all learn pronto whenever you start, is point-to-site networking. So if I go back and I look at my network, that the virtual network the SharePoint farm is deployed into, you can see all the virtual machines that are deployed in this network. You can see 10.0.0.4, .5, .1.4, et cetera. They're all on individual subnets. They don't have to be. It's just I like segregating things, so whenever I look at an IP address, I know what it's supposed to be for. But the thing that's really interesting about this is whenever I created this, I actually enabled point-to-site networking. So what that means, and here's a point-to-site connectivity checkbox, is that I can, from my laptop or my workstation, I can establish a VPN tunnel from my local machine to Azure. So I'm basically on the same network. I don't have to go through that public IP address anymore. So essentially, all I have to do that is enable point-to-site networking. When I create the virtual network, it's just a checkbox. And once it's through, you do have to do some make cert magic. You have to make these two, run these two really long, nasty, horrible commands, which I don't actually know what most of the parameters are. And thankfully, this is documented, otherwise I'd never remember how to do it. But essentially, I'm using makecert.exe to create two self-signed certificates. One of them is a root certificate, and then I create a client certificate based off that root. Once I create these two certificates, I go back into my network configuration, I upload that root certificate, and now Azure has my root certificate, and it also recognizes any client certificates that are used to authenticate against it. Once I have the certificate magic all set up, I can go to dashboard, and over on the very right, I can click download the 64-bit or 32-bit client VPN package. So in this case, I'm running 64-bit Windows. And it'll slowly do this. It's still thinking. There it is. So it's basically going to generate an .exe for you to download. And you don't have to use the .exe. You can actually configure it on your own. But it's so much easier. So once you have the executable, basically just run this. And what it'll generate is it's going to put a new network connection in your over here based on the name of your virtual network. So my SharePoint virtual network is called SPVNet. So I can connect directly to it. And now I'm actually on the same network as my SharePoint VNet. So from there, I don't have to actually connect to the external IP addresses anymore. I can connect directly to 10.0.0.4 and give it my domain account. I remember it, actually. And now I can actually manage and administer all my SharePoint virtual machines over the private network without actually ever going over the, well, it's still going over the public internet, don't get me wrong, but it's now encrypted using SSDP. Okay, so let's jump back over to the slides real quick. So let's talk a little bit more about hybrid connectivity. So I kind of, you know, open it up to point-to-site. But point-to-site, remember, is just one virtual machine to Azure. It's not really perfect, you know, the right model for actually doing real internet deployments. It's really good for admin or, you know, if you're a developer or you're a tester, you need to jump on a network, copy a file, debug something. That's really what point-to-site's for. If you want to do real internet or intranet-based solutions, you really need to start doing site-to-site. Site-to-site is basically a good solution for doing intranet or extranet. It allows you to extend access to on-premises from Azure. So this means you can put your SharePoint farm in Azure, extend a site-to-site network, and then if your SharePoint farm uses, you know, business connectivity services to talk to some on-prem resource like SAP or a SQL server or whatever, it has direct connection back to your network. It also allows you to extend your existing Active Directory up to Azure. So I can have my contoso.com AD on-prem, and then I can boot up a domain controller up in Azure, and they can do AD replication over that tunnel. So site-to-site does require a device or a virtual machine running a VPN software. How it works is essentially you have a public IP address on the internet that you create your virtual network, and basically you pass some keys back and forth and configure them to authenticate with each other, and you have a true site-to-site connection. And this basically allows you to tell it which subnets on your local network can talk to which subnets on the public network. And some of the devices that are supported, Cisco, Juniper, F5, there's a big long laundry list, so if you actually do have a VPN device and you want to check if it's compatible, hit that article and you can kind of find out if it's there or not. And of course, if you don't have a device at all, you just have a Windows server, you can actually just use routing and remote access server from Server 2012 on up and OpenSwan if you're a Linux network guy or girl. Here's just a quick diagram of what this could look like. So an extranet scenario where you have a SharePoint farm running up in Azure, you have users coming in, hitting contoso.com on the external IP, and actually traffic could be going over the site-to-site tunnel. This could be AD replication. Obviously, it doesn't have to. You could have a domain controller that in your SharePoint Cloud is just its own domain. It doesn't even have to actually talk to on-prem. Maybe you just need to access some other data source on-premises, and that's why you establish the site-to-site tunnel for. Another technology is called Microsoft Azure ExpressRoute. So ExpressRoute is site-to-site on major steroids. What it's for, it's basically private low-latency connectivity to the cloud from on-premises. So scenarios for this are production SharePoint farm. Obviously, you know, you have much higher connection, higher much bandwidth, so if you could do it in site-to-site, you can absolutely do it in ExpressRoute. So you can do extranet or intranet scenarios with this. Same thing, you can extend your enterprise identity. You can access on-premises or co-located resources. And another scenario, and I'm going to have a quick demo of this later, is in some situations, ExpressRoute may allow you to do SharePoint stretched farms for disaster recovery. Not all ExpressRoute configurations will do that, depending on your location and proximity to an ExpressRoute access point. So we actually have a demo of that, and we'll walk through that here in just a little while. So the general idea is you either have your own on-premises data center that you're hosting all your servers, your Active Directory, SharePoint, SQL, and it's connected to a network service provider or an internet exchange provider. And I'll walk through each of these in turn. So the first scenario, first provider is an internet exchange provider. This could basically be where you have your SharePoint farm, maybe in a co-located data center. Equinix is a level 3 are both really good examples of this. Whenever you're connecting to these guys, the assumption is most likely your SharePoint farm is actually in the co-located data center. You may have a connection back to another data center in your on-premises location, and maybe you've ran, you got another provider to provide Ethernet, but the general idea is most of the traffic is gonna come from the co-located cage. You'll have your own cage in the data center, you'll have an ExpressRoute circuit set up, and whenever your cage is set up, you allocate an ExpressRoute. Your provider is basically gonna run a fiber line from your cage to Azure, and you have direct connectivity. Exchange providers start from 200 megabytes per second all the way up to 10 gigs. So you can get a really fast pipe to the cloud using this model. The second model, one thing I do wanna say is if you do this, make sure that you have your network guy handy because you are responsible for managing the routing configuration between your router in your cage and the Azure routers on the other side of the circuit. The other model is ExpressRoute using a network service provider. So network service providers, people like AT&T Level 3, these are basically MPLS VPN sessions over a big wide area network. So this is if you have multiple sites, you know, you have site 1 in West Coast, site 2 over in Canada, and site 3, you know, who knows, in England maybe. How Azure works with these providers is essentially you allocate a circuit, and the circuits go as little as 10 megabytes a second all the way up to a gig, and you allocate the circuit, and you don't have to manage the routing. Your actual provider will do that. They'll basically go add an Azure connection to your existing VPN, and Azure just shows up like another site in your network. So it's a cleaner, so it's easier to implement, but definitely doesn't have the performance that a co-located provider would provide. So the demo I'm gonna show is basically a SharePoint stretch farm. It's two locations, it's a data center in Equinix in Silicon Valley, and I have pretty much half the SharePoint farm set up there, and I have the rest of the SharePoint farm set up in Azure, and this is on West US. And note the proximity, so the data center locations really do matter here, because to do a SharePoint stretch farm, you have to have a minimum of 1 millisecond latency consistent. Question? Yeah, so to do a SharePoint stretch farm, you have to have very, very low latency, consistently less than 1 millisecond. And that's why I'm saying the ExpressRoute is a solution, but not, you know, it all depends on where your data center is in proximity to the ExpressRoute location. So the Azure West US data center is very close to the Silicon Valley data center, so latency there is very, very low. The general rule is how I have things configured is I have a couple of web servers, a couple of app servers on-prem, couple of web servers, couple of app servers in Azure. I have SQL with always on in mirroring mode again, doing synchronous commit, so it's not async commit. This is actually live failover. So let's jump over into this configuration. We'll take a look. Okay, so here is So obviously this isn't a real production environment, this is a test environment, but essentially I have two virtual machines, two big beefy virtual machines that I have a bunch of SharePoint VMs on. Just, it's a proof of concept, so it's just really to, excuse me, to prove the point. But as you can see, we have a domain controller, we have an app server on this virtual machine, a web server, and we have two SQL instances running. Now if I flip over to VM host 2, we have a big IP load balancer, so I'm not using Azure internal load balancer, I'm actually using an F5 load balancer, and an app server and a web server. Now this is the on-prem, so these are actually on physical servers in the Equinix data center. Now if I flip over and I look at the SharePoint form it's connected to, takes a few moments to load. Oh, let me disconnect from my point to site connection, it'll go a little faster. So on the SharePoint or the Azure side, I have a SQL Always On server, it's the other side of the mirror, and I have two app servers and two web servers. So if I look at the configuration for each of these, just like the other farm, they're all in appropriate availability sets, except the SQL node, because the pair to the SQL node is the actual on-prem server. So it's actually not paired in Azure. It's the other half of it lives on premises. So if I go back to my on-prem data center, I can load up my F5 credentials. And this is the actual load balancer, and how we have it configured right now is we're actually doing live load balancing between on-prem and Azure. So at this point, we're not disambiguating whether you're coming from on-premise or from another location in Azure, and we're really just round-robining between all four of them. So if you look at the IP addresses here, the 10 IPs, the 10.0s, these are coming from the two web servers in Azure, and the 2.16s are coming from the two web servers on-prem. So obviously with the F5, big IP is really advanced. You can do some crazy things with it. We could write scripts to detect if you're coming from on-prem and only redirect to the on-prem servers, but if you're coming from another region in Azure, maybe we direct you to the servers over in Azure. All depends on how you want to handle that load balancing. But the other thing the F5s are really good at is failure detection. So if it detects my on-prem servers are down, it's going to forward traffic over to the servers over in Azure. So I can have load balancing at the application, the web, and the database level. So if I bring up my SQL server, actually, I should have used another machine. I don't remember what my intranet name is called. There it is, called SP Intranet, I think. We'll find out. There we go. Okay, so this is my mythical Contoso skateboard company. So essentially, we can log in. We can see that we can, yes, access our intranet that has a very lame branding to it, but that's okay. The whole idea is to make sure it all works. So we can basically hit our SP intranet, it's all load balanced through the F5, and what I can do is show you the SQL Always On configuration. If I pull up the Always On availability group, you can see that we do have SQL 01 and SQL 03 AZ. The reason SQL 02 is no longer in the running is because I have this configured in mirroring mode. Mirroring mode will only allow you to have two replicas and a witness. I could do the Always On listener and have a bunch other replicas, but they'd be only read-only nodes and not overly useful for a failover scenario because you can only have two nodes that can have automatic failover. So if you see SQL A001 is a primary node, SQL A03-AZ is the Azure node, so it's completely running in the other data center. Now if I want to test failover, I can just simulate that in Azure or in SQL, failover to the Azure node. So once this is failed over, SharePoint's going to go, oh, I can't connect, and it's probably going to register 500 warnings in the event log, and a few seconds later, it'll actually start connecting to this node in Azure. So I go over here, hopefully it's been long enough to fail over. hit F5, and we're back up and running. So literally, we failed over a SQL cluster between two data centers. Now, to see the latency on why we can do that, this is our consistent pings. So 1 millisecond, 1 millisecond, 1 millisecond. This is the only way you can do a SharePoint stretch farm. Otherwise, the SharePoint team will absolutely not support you. So again, very special cases, but it is absolutely possible to do with ExpressRoute. Okay, so let me just kind of, we talked about a lot of different features, a lot of different attributes that you have to do to configure your virtual machines. I want to kind of go back and recap how all those work and why you should use them. So the very first thing, remember, is when you're deploying multiple servers in SharePoint or in Azure, to make sure and put them in an availability set. Second thing is probably want to put them all with a static IP. Otherwise, someday, somehow, you're going to be painful whenever the IP switches and your DNS server is no longer the right IP or your search server is off somewhere else. Just make yourself a lot easier and put them as static IPs. Configuring load balancing, if you're using external load balancer for SQL always on, make sure that you have an access control list for it, that no, not anyone on the public internet can access your SQL always on server, because that would be really bad from a security perspective. Make sure that you're using a reserved IP for your external VIP. If you're using the internal load balancer, remember that you have to do this at provisioning time. So I can't go and create a bunch of SharePoint servers and have it all configured and then go back and say, oh, I'm going to turn on internal load balancing. I mean, you can, but you'll have to delete all your VMs and recreate them. So do this up front, plan for it. And let me show you, because you notice a couple of these features, reserved IPs, static IPs, I showed them all through PowerShell, and that's because that's the only way you can currently set them right now. Let me show you the script I used to create that earlier SharePoint farm. And don't feel like you have to memorize this. I'd be impressed if you could, honestly. So this is a basic script that provisions all the servers. It doesn't configure anything. It doesn't configure AD. It doesn't configure SharePoint. It doesn't log in and automate anything. It really just sets up all the networking and all the physical servers. So first thing I have is I have the list of the virtual machine images. So there's three different images, one for SharePoint, one for SQL, and one for Windows Server, because I'm booting up AD as well. If you're curious how you can get these virtual machine image names, there is a commandlet for that. Get Azure VM image, and you select out the image name. And there actually is some additional properties you can do to filter on and figure out which one you need, but I just find it easier to look at the name and hope I get the right one best. So you can see there's a lot of them, so you kind of have to scroll through and figure until you figure out which one you want. So first thing you need to do is identify your virtual machine images, pick out your credentials and your cloud service name. You need to pick, if you're going to create a reserved IP, you need to give it a name to reference later. And I'll show you how this kind of works. I can call get Azure reserved IP on my subscription, and it'll tell me that I have the SharePoint IP, and this is the reserved IP address I have. To create a new one, it's pretty straightforward. Tell it the location I want to deploy it to. So if I wanted to make a reserved IP in East US, I create that reserved IP in my subscription, and now when I go to create a virtual machine, I just tell it the reserved IP to use, and from then forward, the cloud service it uses will always have that reserved IP, unless, of course, I delete the cloud service and use it for something else. While that's chugging along, so here's where I created the reserved IP. I created it in the West US region. Then I created the internal load balancer config. And this is, I referenced an IP address, the internal load balancer IP from the web subnet. And if we go back and look at the virtual network configuration, wrong subscription again. We can see basically where I got that subnet and that IP address from as soon as it loads. And we'll come back to it. Okay, and after that, this is all just creating virtual machines. So I'm creating lots and lots of virtual machines, as you can see. This is all the configuration for SPWFE, the very first one. I'm creating the virtual machine. I'm telling it the username and password it's going to use. I'm adding a data disk to it so I can have store web logs, et cetera, telling it it's going to boot up in the web subnet, and it's going to have this static IP. So again, using PowerShell, you can pretty much have full control over everything in Azure. Unfortunately, you do have to write a lot of PowerShell code to do it. So each one of these big blocks starting from here to here is actually a full virtual machine configuration. I didn't split it up for the rest of them because after the first two, it got pretty redundant. But all in all, that's all the code you need to provision your SharePoint farm, and then you get to log in and install all of it. So obviously, don't expect you to memorize it, but I'm actually probably going to post it up on my blog later, so if you do want to download it, give it a shot. You're more than welcome to it. Okay, so let's talk about some general best practices. Once you've mastered the art of putting all this stuff together, created a farm, what are some of the other things you do need to know? So some general deployment tips. Only put SharePoint on the C drive. You don't need other things sharing IOPS with the operating system. If you do need other disks, create disks. Each virtual machine can have up to, depending on the size, it can have anywhere from 2 to data disks up to 16. So make sure you add additional storage if needed, because SharePoint or IOPS in Azure are something that you really need to take advantage of. And each disk in Azure has up to 500 IOPS. And I'll show you a real quick table on how to measure that later. Put each SharePoint logical tier into its own availability set. Hopefully I hammered that in enough. If you're doing SharePoint and you have blob cache, a couple of things you can do with it. Obviously, don't put it on a C drive because it's contending with the operating system. You could potentially put it on the D drive, but remember, this is temporary data. And I've seen customers, whenever they have a gigantic blob cache locally, and then they go delete it, it'll literally hang their servers whenever it starts to refresh that cache. It all depends on how big and how fast you can repopulate that cache for you to consider putting it on the D drive. If you don't want to take that risk, just add another data disk, put the blob cache configure to use that, and you're covered. It's not quite as fast as a D drive, but it's really close. And of course, use static IP addresses so you don't run into the problem of your IP address changing underneath you. And the next thing you should know is, number one way to tune SharePoint is to go back and tune SQL, because everything in SharePoint is pretty much stored in SQL. So if you can make SQL perform well, you can most likely make most of SharePoint perform well. So a couple of things with SQL, split your content databases across multiple disks. So each disk gives its own set of IOPS that you can use, and the more disks, the merrier, right? Because you're spreading those IOPS across. So disk cache settings on virtual machines are tricky. By default, the C drive has read-write and read-write caching enabled on it, which in some cases can be bad for databases. SQL doesn't actually care that much because SQL always does writes with write-through, so it ignores your disk cache settings, so it never corrupts its database. However, in some cases, turning on read caching can actually benefit SQL. There's a really good white paper that goes into way more thorough detail than you'll probably want to know about cache settings in Azure with SQL. Definitely read the white paper, really good reference, but just make sure that if you do consider changing the default cache settings on your Azure disks, that you test it and you know what you're doing. Put database and transaction logs on separate drives. This is SQL anywhere, not specific to Azure, but it does apply to Azure as well. And make sure that you use SQL Server file groups. How many of you know what a SQL Server file group is? Oh, cool. Okay, so what a SQL Server file group is, it basically allows me to take a single database and split that database up over multiple files that I can put on different disks. So if I have multiple disk controllers, multiple disks, then I can take this file, this database and split it up where I get much better I/O because I'm going over different I/O channels. So make sure you take advantage of file groups instead of disk striping. SQL Server is much more intelligent than Windows is on, because it knows the location of its data. Make sure that SharePoint is very heavily dependent on TempDB. Another thing is don't leave TempDB where its default is on the C drive. Move it out to data disk, and you can actually split TempDB up. Question? SharePoint will not leverage file groups?
Yeah.
It probably won't create them, but you can actually go back and split up a database later. And so the question was, will SharePoint or not leverage file groups? SharePoint itself, when it goes off and creates a database, it does not create it in multiple file groups. But you can go back and take your big content database and split them up if you want. And that way SQL is actually doing the I/O for you. But this is outside of what SharePoint knows about. Yeah. So again, it's not something you're gonna do from the central admin, it's something you're gonna do from the SQL side. And it's usually something after your content databases are created. But yeah, definitely look into it. If you're not using FileGroups today, look into it. It's a huge performance boost if you have a pretty good underlying I/O subsystem. You should consider using database page compression to reduce I/O. Sometimes this helps. Again, that's another tweak that you may have to test. And high availability recommendation. So the demo you saw, I had two SQL servers in synchronous commit mode over two different data centers. Be very careful whenever you try to do that on your own. And the reason is because synchronous commit between two SQL replicas means that before SharePoint can continue doing whatever it was doing, both the writes have to be committed in both databases. So you have to have very low latency between those two to make sure that happens in a very timely fashion, or SQL or SharePoint will not like it at all. So usually whenever you're doing split farms like that or they're separated apart, you end up having to have your SQL server replicas in asynchronous commit mode, which means the first node gets written to, and then later the second node gets written to. And in that case, SharePoint's fine with disaster recovery, but it's not an automatic failover. It's a manual failover, and it's actually a pretty long, nasty process. So that's why you need to be really pay attention whenever you do split those replicas up on your latency. So a little bit more on SQL Server. Looks like a lot of that's redundant, but that's okay. So one thing I do want to point out, and probably none of you are aware of this, but how the underlying storage account that you create for storing your disks in Azure has a feature on it called geo-replication. And what that does is any blob that I write, so I put a VHD file, I put an image, a movie, whatever, inside of Azure Storage, I can have Azure automatically replicate that data to a different region. So if I have all my disks in East US, I can have it replicate all my disks to West US too. That way I have a complete and total backup of my VMs, my data, in a different data center. So, you know, we lose the East Coast, we still have the West Coast, that kind of thing. However, SQL Server, if you split your database and your log files up on separate disks, doesn't work very well in that configuration because geo-replication is asynchronously written. So you actually may have writes going to the log files before or after they were written to the disk, and things will start getting out of sync, and that data that you have on that remote data center actually won't be usable by SQL because all the writes and the timestamps will be wrong. So the moral to the story is if you do split the database and log files up into different drives, make sure you go into your storage account and uncheck geo-replication. It's not that it's going to hurt the data, it's just it won't be usable, and that storage count is actually about 25-30% higher if you have geo-replication turned on. Each storage count itself, so you know when I created a VM, I just picked a storage count and clicked next. Whenever you're actually architecting real solutions, you do need to be careful about how many disks and how many virtual machines are backed to a storage account. A storage account can have up to 20,000 IOPS, so 20,000 IO operations per storage account per second. A virtual machine disk in Azure can have up to 500. So if you do the math, at some point, you're going to have too many servers on that one storage account, and you're actually going to hit the storage the IOPS capacity of that storage account. And what that means is basically you need to know how many IOPS or be able to guesstimate how many IOPS and then add additional storage counts as you need them. And scale out, not up. Everyone doing it that's a SharePoint admin should already know this because SharePoint can have a SQL cluster for every database there is. You can have infinite number of SQL servers for SharePoint, and that's probably the best route to scale your SharePoint farms in Azure because there's always going to be an upward capacity of how much compute and I/O you can get off of a single server. And here's just a little bit more detail on the IOPS that you can get out of a storage account in your disk. And it's just something that you need to keep in the back of your mind whenever you're planning out your SharePoint farms and, you know, deploying other servers on that storage account. Okay, AD, so if you do deploy Active Directory in Azure, obviously don't put it on anything other than a virtual network, because if it's outside of a virtual network, you don't have static IPs. And if you point your virtual machine to it, join the domain, and you reboot your DC, it's going to have a different IP, and your clients are all lost. So it doesn't work very well. Make sure it's a static IP. Probably want to put it in its own subnet because even with static IPs, there's still a risk of conflicts if you have other virtual machines that don't have static IPs. So make sure it's in its own subnet to make sure there's not going to be any issues with that. Whenever you install AD on a server in Azure, remember it always asks you, we're going to put the DIT drive, NTDS, sysvol, all that good stuff. Make sure you put it on a data disk because by default, C drive in Azure has read-write caching enabled on it. And if you have a power problem or your server goes dead, While AD is trying to write to the database, it may be cached and you may corrupt your database. Put it on a data disk, which has absolutely zero caching on by default, and you won't have that problem. And there's a lot more behind that. There's actually whole hour-long sessions on just deploying AD in Azure. So go read the articles if you're really gonna do this, get more detailed information on how it works. Okay, most of you said you had MSDN subscriptions. I just remember that, I'll jump to MSDN site. If you don't have an MSDN subscription, grab the free trial. You get 30 days, basically $200 usage. That's actually quite a bit of compute power. You get to try out SharePoint quite a bit for 30 days for free. If you have MSDN and you haven't activated your benefit, make sure you do, because depending on your MSDN level, whether you're professional, premium, or ultimate, you get basically free Azure usage every month off of it. Sure. Excuse me? Yeah, so the question is a free trial and $200? And the answer is yes. So essentially you get 30 days of usage up to $200 is what the trial is. So MSDN dev and test pricing, this is really nice. Whenever you're thinking about Azure, this kind of an old slide, the old free trial and old MSDN usage actually broke it down on which servers you could use. You know, you could send 200 messages to Service Bus, you could make 20,000 writes to storage. Now it's just they give you a big fat pile of cash to try out with your MSDN usage, and it makes it nice and simple. The other nice thing that you should know is pretty much every service in Azure or every virtual machine SKU, like if I'm booting up a SQL Enterprise server on a virtual machine image, the rate for that is actually pretty expensive. I mean, I won't say expensive, but it's not what you would expect from looking at just doing dev and test. If you're using MSDN, you're paying 6 cents an hour for a virtual machine running SQL server. That's incredibly cheap. It's just bare bones compute time at that, because you're basically paying for the license as part of your MSDN. You already have it, you've already paid for it, and you can use those directly in Azure. Where, be warned, if you do try to deploy dev and test outside of an MSDN subscription using SQL Image or BizTalk, you're going to be paying the full license price for it. So just keep that in mind whenever you're booting up these virtual machines. So another couple of things you can try, there's automation scripts that you literally can download from GitHub. You download these PowerShell scripts, hit F5, give it your subscription name, and it'll go spin up a 27-core farm for you in SharePoint or in Azure, and you can try it out yourself. If they're broken, I'm sorry, I wrote them. Sometimes they are. Sometimes they work great, though. There's two configurations you can try. One of them is highly available. It creates literally 27 cores. It's a very big deployment. The other one is a single VMs template. So literally creates three VMs, SharePoint, SQL, and AD. Much smaller, much easier to manage. Really good way to give it a shot and figure out how Azure works. So. And of course, if you're really interested in this, there's a bunch of other stuff you need to know about if you're new to Azure, mostly in the networking space, but there also is a talk on using SQL Server on Azure. So if you want to get more tips and performance benefits of running SQL Server actually in an Azure VM, there's a session tomorrow. And there's two other sessions on networking and hybrid connectivity that will follow nicely with this session, so if you want to learn more. All right. So thank you very much. That's pretty much everything you need to know to get started on SharePoint. So if you do have any more questions, feel free to come up after stage. I'll be answering questions. And of course, make sure you enter an eval and maybe you'll win an Xbox One. Or if you're already a build, you probably already have one. And make sure you do an eval, please. Cool, thank you very much.